Welcome to Walking in Faith, featuring interviews and reviews that help you rediscover the Catholic faith in our culture. And now here is your host, Barbara Schenkel.
Good morning and welcome to Walking in Faith. This morning we have three interviews for you. First up, we start with Carl Keating of Catholic Answers. So many of you know him as the founder of that wonderful evangelization ministry. He's here to talk about a new book called The Ultimate Catholic Quiz, and I'll bet you money that you may not know the answers to many of the questions he poses in that book. And then following that interview, we speak with Tony Ryan. He's here to talk about a new DVD put out by Ignatius Press on St. Joan of Arc. And we'll talk about some of the books about Joan of Arc and the historical accuracies of some of the presentations that have been made about her through the ages. And then lastly, we have an interview with a new author, Robert Ovies. He's here to talk about his suspense thriller, Barely a Crime. And he also has a great apostolate called Couple Prayer. We'll get into that as well. So let's bring you those interviews right now. Good morning. This morning we're joined by Carl Keating. Many of you know him as the founder of Catholic Answers. Welcome, Carl.
Thank you, Barbara. Glad to be with you.
Well, I can't say enough about this book. You have written a new book called The Ultimate Catholic Quiz, and it is very humbling for people who think they know it all to take these quizzes. Talk a little bit about the inspiration behind this book.
Well, quite some years ago, for Catholic Answers magazine, I wrote a short quiz, 10 or 20 questions, just to get a sense of what people might know or think they might know about the faith. Then I took that on the road a bit, and I gave a variant of that quiz to some groups that I spoke with. And then as I discovered that most people couldn't answer most of the questions. And now bringing it up to today, I've expanded on those ideas considerably. So the Ultimate Catholic Quiz has 100 questions, and each one has 5 possible answers. The fifth possible answer always is none of the above. And very often, that's the right answer. None of the questions is a trick question. I'm not trying to fool anybody or pull a fast one. But all of them demand that you give thought to whether each of the possible answers really is correct completely or maybe just correct in part. So I've had a lot of fun putting this together, and I'm getting a lot of good response to it. And people are, learning some things about the faith, but they're also learning that maybe they need to do a little more homework.
Well, what's so great about it is if you had just written a book explaining all these different truths, people might be ho-hum bored, but when you put it in the Trivial Pursuit type of format, it's an intriguing way to want to know more.
Well, I think when you start going through a book like this, you see that you know some things, and it gives you a kind of shot in the arm, a sense of confidence. Hey, I know that. I've scored a point. I got one right. But then you come across another one that you don't get the right answer to, and you begin to think, maybe I need to do a little more study. Maybe I thought I knew more than I really know. And there's a challenge in that, and that's sort of encouraging. I remember the very first time I engaged in apologetics quasi-publicly, it was when a missionary came to my door, and he flipped through the Bible trying to disprove Catholic things. I knew he was wrong in everything he was saying. I didn't know how to respond, except when he finally got to Matthew 16:18, you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church. I just happened to be studying that the week before, and so I knew how to formulate an answer, and I did successfully. I threw him for a loop. But what I came away with from that encounter was a sense of confidence. I said, look, I answered just one question correctly today. Okay. But since I could answer one, I know I can answer 10 if I do a little study. And if I can answer 10, I can answer 100. And so that's the way I've learned apologetics, learned the faith over the years, is when I haven't known something, I look it up. And so my book, The Ultimate Catholic Quiz, is intended to be a kind of spur to Catholics and non-Catholics to get them to think that, A, they know more than they probably think they know, B, they also know less than they probably think they know, and see, it's not that hard to learn what you don't know.
Indeed. And, there's something about the question and answer format. It's as old as the faith. I mean, Thomas Aquinas, his Summa, is that question and answer kind of format, too. I mean, this obviously is not anywhere in terms of the density of reading Aquinas, but it takes that same idea that transmitting the faith almost by discerning what we don't teach as well as what we do.
Indeed. Matthew, you mentioned Aquinas. Let me throw one of the questions at you, because Aquinas is mentioned in one of the answers. Maybe you've already gone through this, but let's see how we do, just to give the listeners a sense of how the book's put together. So, as I say, every question has five possible answers. And here's this particular question that I'm picking almost at random. And let's see how you do. Who were the first to establish that the existence of God can be known through reason alone, apart from revelation? So the first possible answer, A, ancient Greek, that is, pagan philosophers. B, the fathers of the church, that is, those writing from the 1st to the 4th centuries A.D. C, Thomas Aquinas and other medieval theologians. D, it is not true that God's existence can be known by reason alone. Faith also is necessary. Or E, none of the above. So again, who are the first to establish that we can prove God's existence by reason alone? A, the ancient Greeks. B, the fathers of the church. C, Thomas Aquinas. Or D, the premise is false. You can't prove his existence by reason alone, or none of the above. So, well, looking at that, Father, what would you do?
Well, I am such a fan of Pope Benedict XVI, so I'm going to have to rule out the answer that says we cannot know God by reason alone, because absolutely, I think we can. In creation.
Okay, now that's a good way to approach this, because you've got some item in your mind, and you can say, okay, I can exclude at least one of the answers.
Yes.
Okay, all right. That leaves you four, though.
Now, it would have been harder if you'd put in Augustine. That would have really thrown me for the loop. But I guess sort of in the patristic fathers, you have that. I guess that he would be included in that. I'm going to go out on a limb here. And I'm going to say that the Greeks were able to know that you could discern a godlike being or presence by reason. They were big on reason, weren't they?
They were. And matter of fact, you're right. The Greeks, such as Plato and Aristotle, were able to prove by reason alone that God exists. They were able to prove some of his attributes, like omniscience, omnipresence, and so forth. What they couldn't prove, though, from reason alone, is God's personhood, really his triple personhood, which, of course, had to be revealed to us by Jesus Christ. Nevertheless, they were able to prove that God exists, and they just used reason to do it. So that's the right answer. But this is one that most
sort of
people get wrong.
I just had a Catholic morality course that went through some of that. So ask me another. See if you can trip me up, because I did. That was kind of fresh in my mind.
Okay, let's see. How's this one? Oops. I just dropped my book. Now I have to pick it up from the floor again.
I like the question you had about baptism in an emergency. Can you use beer? And the answer is no.
No, the answer is no. You can't use beer. Okay, here's one. The church founded by Christ, A, came to be the Catholic Church after Christianity was legalized by the Roman Emperor Constantine, or B, is called Catholic, which means universal, because she's found in every country in the world, or C, began at Christ's ascension and will continue until the end of the world, or D, is a perfect society, or E, none of the above. So, the church, A, came to be the Catholic Church under Constantine, or B, is called Catholic because it's found in every country in the world, or C, began at the Ascension, or D, is a perfect society, or E, none of the above.
That's tricky. It is tricky, because I would be tempted to say Pentecost rather than the Ascension.
Are you going to choose the Ascension?
No, I'm not. I'm going to say the universal answer.
All right. Well, wrong.
Okay.
Let me explain first why that's right. The church is called Catholic because the word means universal, but not because the church is found in every country in the world. Not that there are places that you don't find
any
Catholics.
Oh, that is the trick. Okay, yeah.
Okay. It's called Catholic because it's intended to be everywhere for everyone. Everybody's ought to be a Catholic. And so the church is established for all of mankind, for all time, everywhere, even if a lot of people don't realize it yet. Okay, so that's not the right answer. It should be easy to eliminate the first one, that the church became the Catholic Church under Constantine. Christian team.
Right.
That, of course, wasn't the situation.
But, you know, that is a big misunderstanding. Everybody assumes that is.
It is. I mean, the church became legalized under Constantine, but obviously existed before that. So that should be really a sort of easy one to get. Answer C was that the church began at the Ascension. And no, you had the right answer. It was at Pentecost. We just celebrated that. So Pentecost is the birthday of the church. The actual answer is D, that the church is a perfect society. That answer throws people because they don't really appreciate what the church means by the term perfect society. It doesn't mean that the church is perfect in her members, each of whom is a sinner. Okay. So that's very imperfect to be a sinner. Now, what it means, according to Pope Leo XIII, in my quote, is that according to her nature and her rights, the church possesses in herself and by herself, by the will and goodness of her founder, everything necessary for her existence and her efficacy. That is, the church has within itself everything needed to do its job and to do it as well as God wants it to be done. You know, we've got the sacraments, we've got the magisterium, we've got all these things. The church is able to do what it needs to do. To the extent Catholics fail, it's their fault. It's not the church's fault. It's that we as individuals, as sinners, fail. But the actual answer is that the church is a perfect society. So that's a question and answer that requires one to know a particular theological term that is perfect society. And if you don't know that, you're probably going to miss that. So that's probably one of the trickiest, closest to I have to a tricky question in the Ultimate Catholic Quiz.
But that's fascinating, though. I mean, in terms of the idea that if we live in the grace of God, in the church, with all that he's given us through the church, and are open to being what he desires us to be, that is the perfect way to live on earth. That is the perfect society. That is the utopia. We're only not getting that based on our own inability to...
Because of our own fault, our own limitations. Not because the church doesn't have enough grace for us. We're not making use of it. That's the problem. So it's not as though that we've done everything we can and we come back to the church and say, hey, I need more and you can't give me more. You know, you can't give me what I need. No, the church can give us everything we need because the church is Christ's extension on earth. And he can give us everything. The point is, we often don't ask for it, or when we do, we don't make good use of it.
Well, in terms of that question too, Carl, how important is that in terms of when we look at the way our culture is structured today with regards to things like capitalism, socialism, communism, the fact that that God intends man to live a certain way and the church really is mother and teacher.
That's right. That's right. And the church, I mean, always teaches, but often that teaching is obscured by the noise around us.
Yeah.
And there's probably more noise nowadays than almost any other time. So the church and her truth are there right in front of our eyes, and we're often oblivious to them. So what I'm trying to do in the Ultimate Catholic Quiz is to get the reader, first have some fun, because it is a fun book. It's great for individual study or for group study. I've used it with, you know, some of these questions with groups. And people have a great time, even though they often get most of them wrong. In fact, I remember giving some of these questions to a group of Catholic business people and their spouses, and I allowed the spouses to work, you know, together, husband and wife could put their heads together to come up with the answers. And yet, in the quiz, they only got about 60% right on average, and these were good mass-going Catholics. And they were colluding with one another and still got hardly more than half right. So these are tough questions. The Ultimate Catholic Quiz is published by Ignatius Press, so, you know, it can be had at Ignatius.com or Amazon or through Catholic Answers at Catholic.com or your local Catholic bookstore. And I'm getting a lot of nice response to it. I'm very pleased with that. People are using it privately in groups, parish study, RCIA, all those kinds of things, because it is fun. Of course, in 100 questions, I'm not trying to cover everything about the faith, but I do dip into a lot of areas. I've got sacraments and history and personalities and morality and the basic elements of the creed. All these kinds of things are addressed, you know, just one way or another in this book. I think it's going to be something that will send a lot of people to want to do a little more homework on their own, learn their faith a bit better, share it with others, and have some fun doing so.
And I love how you have the how do you rank in the very back part of the book. It tells you
Yes. Once
you take the quiz, where you go.
Yeah, I gave an early copy of the book to one of my relatives who's not a Catholic. And she went through it. She got 56 out of 100 right, which is actually very good. Not even bad for a Catholic, but it's very good for non-Catholic. But she, you know, would not have ranked particularly high there. It's a little hard to get even a gentleman's D in this book. But I said, if you can get a score of 60 or better, you're probably ready to take over the adult ed class at your parish.
I like that. Yeah.
And if you're 80 or above, you're really in an exclusive club. And if you get them all right, which nobody ever has, but if you were to get them all right, you should be working full-time as a Catholic apologist.
It's a great book. We've been speaking with Carl Keating. Again, it's called The Ultimate Catholic Quiz, 100 Questions That Most Catholics Can't Answer. Well, Carl, we thank you for your time today and always for your work. We are an EWTN affiliate for Catholic Answers, that are one of the most popular shows that we have here on our radio station. So thank you for all you're doing to increase people's knowledge of this perfect society, which is the Catholic Church. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And we'll be back right after the station identification. You are listening to Holy Spirit Radio, 1570 AM in Doylestown and 1420 AM in Coatesville and Chester County.
We would understand. You are the rock of salvation, the only foundation, Lord of all. You are our hope never failing. A mighty fortress is our God.
Good morning. This morning we're speaking with Anthony Ryan from Ignatius Press here to talk about a brand new DVD, Joan of Arc. Welcome.
Thank you, Barbara. Nice to be on.
Well, tell us about this DVD. So many different things have been done about Joan of Arc. How is this movie different?
Well, this movie is different than any other movie made on Joan of Arc in many ways, actually. It's an epic film, first of all. So it's 3 hours long. It was made as a television series. I think it was a two-part series for television. It's a big budget film for television. I think it was like $20 million, which is major budget for a television movie. It has a big name cast in it. An all-star cast, really. I mean, the young woman that plays Joan of Arc, Lili Sobieski, was 19 at the time, so about the age of Joan of Arc, and became a pretty well-known actress as she grew up. It also stars Peter O'Toole, Jacqueline Bisset, Maximilian Schell, Peter Strauss, Olympia Dukakis, and others. So it's got a great cast, big budget film. I think they did a good job in following the true story of Joan of Arc and portraying her as both a woman who obviously was heroic in a military way, but also a saint. You know, a woman who was very devout, who was a woman who completely trusted in God amidst really challenging circumstances. That she knew she was called by God to lead this military campaign as a 19-year-old girl, so or young woman, and I think the film really captures that,
and really does take on too the Catholic aspects of the film. Many of the portrayals of Joan of Arc, you could have sort of caricatures of bishops and portraying them as villains with regards to how the Church reacted to the revelations that Joan was receiving about her mission. There's a Catholic presence in this film in that it treats these subjects not sort of as comic book characters, right?
Yeah, that's true. It does really respect the Catholic Church, and it wasn't made by a Catholic company. It was made for television, so it was made by a regular film studio, but the people that wrote it and were involved with it, I think, if they're not Catholics, they certainly have a real true respect for the Catholic Church. So they show that in the film, as you say, the bishops and others, religious, are, you know, they're portrayed with true respect, and even you know, the bishop who opposed her, who's played by Peter O'Toole, you know, it doesn't show him as a completely evil guy. I mean, he was just misguided, you know. He thought he was doing the right thing, at least at the time. Hopefully later, I think he realized he was wrong, but, you know, in having her condemned as a heretic, he really thought that. And so they try to show him fairly, and even though, you know, he's kind of a bad guy, but so overall the film gives a very respectful portrayal of the Catholic Church and its members.
But important to say too that this is a Hollywood version of Joan of Arc. I mean, if you want a serious biography or if you want historical accuracy, Ignatius Press also puts out a number of publications with regards to Joan of Arc. In fact, a classic in The Maid of Orleans. And also you have the Mark Twain classic that you sell at Ignatius Press as well.
We do. So exactly. And we have a companion booklet that we produce with the DVD, 16 pages, that gives a lot of good information as well about Joan of Arc. But if you want to go deeper than that, as you mentioned, we have some several books on her, actually. We have the Maid of Orleans, as you mentioned. It's actually called, the subtitle is very interesting, The Life and Mysticism of Joan of Arc. It was written by a Swedish writer, a convert named Sven Stolpe. Vincent Ryan did the introduction to it. But anyway, it's a great book on Joan. It really focuses on her mysticism. Most books do not. And he shows how she, everything she did was really based on her spiritual life, on her mystical experiences. That's what drove her. And then the famous book by Mark Twain, Joan of Arc, which, he considered his greatest book of all of his books. He spent 12 years in research and, I don't know, 7 years in writing it or something. It's incredible. Mm. We also have a book for children written by Louis DeWol on Joan of Arc, for young people, part of our Vision book series. And we have one by Régine Pernaut, a famous French historian, on the retrial of Joan of Arc. They actually did a retrial of her.
Exonerated.
Some years after she died to prove her innocence. Mm-hmm. And plenty of reading materials after you see the movie.
Well, Anthony, you mentioned the little guide that you get when you get the DVD. And it's really a mini biography. It takes into account all of the different variations and themes that have been sort of pronounced about Joan of Arc. I mean, she's been portrayed by many sides as sort of the leader in their cause. And this little study guide really will help you through all of those myths and some of the wrong applications of St. Joan of Arc with regards to political causes and things like that. The other thing is that you will find out how Mark Twain, who was not Catholic, ended up researching St. Joan and becoming so influenced by her. And I love that little fact in your booklet, Anthony, that it was just fortuitous that a stray piece of paper crossed his path as he was walking about town.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a great story. I mean, it really is, you would have to call that providential. He didn't really know anything about Joan of Arc. Well, it's not even clear if he even knew who she was. He was not a historian, that's not what he was. And but when he this piece of paper, he picked it up, blown across the sidewalk. As he's walking down the street in his hometown there in, I think, Missouri, and it had something about Joan of Arc on there, and it just caught his attention. You know, I forget exactly what it said about her, but it was something that caught his attention, and he was like, "Wow, I got to find out more about this woman." And so then he started doing research on her and became completely taken up by her, completely inspired by this woman. And he ended up going to France and researching all the archives on her. And he just, he felt like she was one of the greatest, if not the greatest, person who ever lived. That's how much he came to respect Joan of Arc. And as I mentioned, he spent all those years researching her book, really researching her, I mean researching for his book on her, many years, and he said, you know, my other books got no research and they didn't need any. And so, anyway, he felt like Joan of Arc was by far his best work.
That's something. Yeah, and I also wanted to point out that, you know, you have so many controversies right now with regards to women's roles in the church, and there is talk of Pope Francis having a commission on women deacons. And Anthony, what would you say in terms of the church and its role with women and the very fact that God used St. Joan to affect the course of a nation? What would that do in terms of stirring people's hearts to understand the church and the role of women in the church a little bit more fully?
Well, that's a good question. The role of women in the church. Joan of Arc is often misunderstood, as you were talking about. You know, she is there. She's taken as kind of a mistaken kind of as a model by feminists, New Age people, people who are, you know, into even witchcraft. I mean, they see her as kind of, you know, oh, look, she went among all these men and you know, she kind of helped these poor fumbling men to understand, you know, what it means to really be, you know, a leader or whatever. But I think, and that's not right. I mean, she was, you know, so God called her. She was a woman who really was doing what God wanted her to do, plain and simple. Had nothing to do about Joan of Arc's own ego, about wanting to be a feminist, wanting to one-up all the men who couldn't get the job done. No, I mean, she really knew nothing about military. You know, she just was following the call of God. And the point is, if you follow the will of God in your life, you can do great things. And but you need the grace of God to do those things, and that's what she relied on. She didn't rely on her own abilities because she didn't have any abilities. She was not a military person. But what happened was the men had such respect for her as a woman, and because of her faith and her purity, that they they trusted her. They respected her. They treated her with great respect. So there was never any scandal with her. You can imagine, here's this beautiful 19-year-old young woman who was amidst men, all men, basically. And there weren't any women around, if any. And yet, there was never any scandal with her. They had this huge respect for her, and her purity. She was pure, and so she, you know, the men followed that. They that's what really got them in line. They were completely in disarray before she showed up, and they needed a leader. And so I think that's the message that, you know, if a woman acts true to her character, like Joan of Arc did, is a beautiful, pure vessel of God, somewhat like Our Lady, who, of course, was on a much higher scale, you know, the power of the grace of God can do great things through women who, you know, as Mother Teresa said, when they used to say to her, well, what about women being priests? You know, that whole thing. And she'd say, why should I worry about being a priest when I can be a saint? You know? And so that's the great calling of both men and women, is to be saints. And that's what Joan of Arc was.
Well put. We've been speaking with Anthony Ryan from Ignatius Press. We're talking about the DVD, Joan of Arc, now available as a great resource just to help you learn more about history of the Catholic Church in France and how it interplayed with regards to nation states at that time, and also just a great movie to understand the spiritual life as well. Well, we thank you so much for your time.
Barbara, thanks for having me on, and thanks for the great work you're doing on Catholic Radio.
Well, we look forward to speaking with you again in the future, Anthony.
Likewise.
All right. Bye-bye.
So long.
You are listening to Walking in Faith, right here at Holy Spirit Radio, 1570 AM in Doylestown, 1420 AM in Coatesville and Chester County. Good morning. This morning we're joined by author Robert Oviez. He's written the new novel, Barely a Crime, published by Ignatius Press. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Tell me about your decision to write this book and how a little bit about the characters and your inspiration behind it.
Well, I actually thought of a situation which I think is really going to be a very important situation for the world and for the culture very soon now. And I got thinking about that and thought, my gosh, to look at it in this point of view would really be a thrilling story. And so I just really set out to write a thriller. It's in a context, certainly it's a morality tale, and it's in a context that allows for a lot of action and things like that. The underlying current of it is that it's called Barely a Crime, first of all. And the underlying current of it is it's similar to if you ever stood in a shallow part of the ocean, like 3 feet of water, and ever felt the undercurrent pulling you back out into the middle of the ocean. It's one of those situations where, and I believe this is very much, very true, that there really is no such thing as barely a crime. And playing God is a dangerous, dangerous game. And so it's a group of four people that, with their aspirations and their hopes, and they're all mixed. There's no purely bad person or purely saintly person, but they have their wounds, they have their aspirations and so forth, and they get involved with something that they rationalize themselves and say, well, this is barely a crime. And because that undercurrent clicks in when we decide to mess with the lines of morality and, you know, what is good and what is evil, relative to your last discussion, there is that undercurrent, and these people get caught up in it. So it's a story of how they start to realize it, or some of them start to realize it more than others, and they're involved now, and what do you do, and what would the reader do if they were caught up in this situation at this time? So hopefully it's satisfying. The reviews on Amazon are really good, and that's, you know, thank you, God. I appreciate that, but that's what it is. It's a morality tale about the undercurrent of messing with playing God.
Now, Joseph Pierce, who we have had on the show before, the author of Catholic Literary Giants, compare writing to Flannery O'Connor. That must be quite the ultimate.
Oh, my gosh, I almost fell off my chair. I thought, oh, my goodness. I, you know, certainly didn't expect to aspire to something like that. That was quite a compliment, and I appreciate that very much.
But everyone mentions the same thing. It's a suspense book. It has a great cliffhanging, page-turning kind of quality to it. If you could describe for our listeners just sort of the setting and the characters in terms of, you know, where it's located and who the main characters were. I know they're from Ireland. So talk a little, just get our imaginations going with how you frame the story.
Okay, sure. Yeah, it takes place in Ireland and Italy for reasons that clarify themselves in the book. But it's somebody's, a very brilliant guy. He works with cloning. He's interested in cloning, and he has a research firm and everything, and he wants to be obscure, so he gets people from out of this country. He's from America, but he gets people from out of the country. And he insists that they not know too much details, but he wants them to go on a project with them. And his view of it is that cloning is going to change the world. And I do think that's an underlying issue that is, it's just explosive. It's ready to go off. There's actually only one more scientific hurdle for the cloning industry. The Human Genome Project claims that cloning a human being is the end goal of the Human Genome Project. And there's only actually one little hurdle that it may not be a little hurdle, God willing, they'll never get over it, but there's only one hang-up to human cloning now. They're cloning everything else, as you know. They have water buffaloes and birds and fish and everything else. But in primates, there's this one little hang-up. So he's convinced that he has overcome that hang-up, and he's going to get them involved in cloning the first walk around the neighborhood, shaking hands with your neighbor human being. After which he envisions designing cloning, where people walk in and say, I've got some DNA from the hair of, Marilyn Monroe. I want a daughter like her, but somebody who plays the piano, and we'll kind of dialed up our own children, you know. That is a possibility that's very seriously being looked at. China, I was interested just last week, I read an article that China's just finished construction on a $21 million cloning factory outside of Beijing. They're going to be cloning 2 million cattle a year to help feed China, and they're going to clone racehorses and favorite pets and all this kind of thing. So it's kind of, to me, it's kind of a sleeping giant in the room, not getting much attention, but if and when they jump that last hoop, it's going to be hell on wheels. It's going to be, it's going to very much impact. And so that's what this guy is aspiring to, that he can clone perfect people, you know, people that will just be wonderful and there won't be any more sin, there won't be any more trouble in the world. And of course, it gets out of hand as far as his aspirations go. So that's the thriller part of it. They get involved, and now what are they bringing out of this? They never even get to the cloning, but the whole aspect of it is pretty clear in the story, I hope. And again, it's hopefully a thriller as far as how they get in, and then several of them try to get out, and so on and so forth. I go back to several of the characters to shape why they are who they are, what they're afraid of, what they're hoping for. And again, they all have a good side, and I think that's realistic. I wrote another book called The Rising, too, and it's a thriller, but in both of them, I really know the characters well. I shape them on people that I've worked with and lived with. We've had a lot of personal experiences in the inner city and suburbs and Navajo Reservation and on different missions and things like that. And I've tried to really frame them as real characters. There's nobody with that age involved in the story at this time, and yet I go back to the time when they were that age to just point out, here's what's driving this girl, for example. She, you know, she never wants to have to go through this again. And so things come up in that respect, but they are four adults, with the one guy being the brilliant guy who rounds them up and says, okay, are you in or out? Because it'll be all kinds of money for you if you're in. And they all say, well, we need the money for this and that and the other thing. And then they get sucked into this undercurrent. So how do they get out? That's the question.
Talk a little bit about the Catholic themes that run through the book.
Well, it's settled. The theme is, it's not an overt situation as far as people in the Catholic Church, but they're skirting the church. It's very much shaped in how they skirt the church. So they have to invade a church to get this thing done, and so that's where the moralities come up. And I think it's more like a shadow presence. It is like the Connery thing. It's a hanging presence through the whole thing. There's this, this recognition that we are messing with revelations that are several thousand years old here, and they're willing to run the risk of breaking the edges a little bit. So in that respect, it's complicated, and yet the way it comes out in the story, it's not like a puzzlement or something. It's just we want this more than we want the safety. We want to run this risk. And again, there's very clearly a morality theme to it, and it's shaped around a Catholic cathedral.
Now, I want you to talk a little bit about your background. You are a former advertising executive.
And yeah, I was a creator at an advertising agency, in a large advertising agency, and retired out of that. My wife and I went out and lived on the Navajo Reservation for a couple of years. We had our first child died, and I think it was a response to that we just wanted to get out of that world, out of the chase, and just go and pray and be alone. So we lived at a Franciscan mission for a couple of years, taught school, and did things on the Navajo Reservation. Then we came back to the Detroit area, and we met, in effect, in a section of Detroit they call Corktown. We were both doing, like, mission work and living down in the inner city at that time. And so we gravitated somewhat back into ministry there. And then I got a job as the family life director of the Archdiocese of Detroit, and in the context of that, I enrolled in the diaconate program. I've been a deacon now for over 30 years, permanent deacon in the church.
Did you ever imagine yourself writing?
Yeah, I love to write, but I really never thought of writing fiction. I'm writing spiritual books now. I'm in the middle of one that I think is going really well. God willing, it'll be a blessing. But with the first book, The Rising, I got to wondering, you know, what if somebody really had a power that clearly came from God, but it was really dramatic, and that power would be, I thought, what if somebody could raise the dead today? And I was thinking, with the social media that it is, with the communications what it is, with pads and phones and all this kind of thing, if somebody could raise the dead, especially if they were very vulnerable, like how about a 9-year-old boy who doesn't have a parent or doesn't have a father living in the house with him, the world would eat him alive. That's what I started thinking about. The world would just eat people alive if that could actually happen. So I played that out with a story, and that was The Rising. And then during the course of that, I actually got thinking about this other theme and this other playing with fire story that I thought, gee whiz, that would be a lot of fun to read and write. And so I pursued this Barely a Crime, and here I am, I got two novels. I never dreamed, short of 4 or 5 years ago now, that I'd ever try to write any fiction. And they just kind of happened, and like I say, I'm back to doing spiritual things now. My wife and I have a program, I hope it's okay to mention it, but there's a website called coupleprayer.com, and that whole program has been very successful, and it's to help married couples get to a point where they can pray with one another just openly and comfortably and naturally and supportively, you know. Because that doesn't really happen a lot in Catholic marriages or in any denomination, we've come to find out. So I kind of bounced around a little bit from, you know, the advertising to the diaconate to the novels to the spiritual books, but it's interesting and it's a lot of fun. I got a call yesterday from a lady who said, I just wanted to find your number and call you and saying, thanks for keeping me awake all night. I can't put the book down. She laughed and I laughed. And so the novels are fun. They're just fun. And hopefully there's a moral thread that's obvious and speaks to some serious issues. But it's not a ponderous look at any real serious issues, I don't think.
And how do you think why is it important that Catholic authors start using their talents in the literary fields to even just provoke thoughts or discussions in our culture?
I first of all, I think it's important for Catholic authors, and I think it's important for Christian authors beyond the Catholic denomination, because I think, and I heard a little bit of your previous discussion too, I think this is really a time, the ungluing of a society, of a culture, is happening right now before our eyes. I honestly, you know, I certainly trust that God brings good out of anything, but I weep for our kids, for my kids and my grandkids, and I think, what kind of world are they going to grow up in? It's not going to be the happy days that my wife and I grew up in. There really is an evil current in the way things are, you know, the magnetic pull of things today. It's more and more obvious. And I don't mean just ISIS and, you know, terrible things like that. I mean the culture, you know, what we aspire to, what we think is cool and what we think is valuable. And the Christians are being intentionally, in my mind, suffocated, you know, pushed out. So, gosh, this is sure a time, I think, for anybody who really has a close relationship with Christ and with the Bible and with the church and, you know, with any real believing church, I think we got to get out and get back into the marketplace and get back into people's visibility, you know, lines of vision, and continue to share the good news. That's what Jesus said. Now the good news must be shared. I mean, that must be shared. And we all know what the good news is. It's the real identity. identity of God and the character of God and the presence of God and salvation. And gosh, in the diaconate especially, in working in the inner city and the reservations, so many people are hungry for that, and they're just desperately hungry, and they don't know what it is. They really don't know what it is. At least that's my point of view. I mean, other people may see it a little less seriously, but I think what's happening is very, very serious.
Indeed.
And God's the answer. It really is the answer. People tell me that's simplistic. It's not simplistic. It's bone deep. And, you know, to really understand that God has visited us in the flesh, and we have the way, and we have the book, and we have the message, we have the good news, and we're a light in the darkness. Got to get out there. Got to share it.
Indeed. And the idea that you have revealed truth, infinitely greater and infinitely better and more wise than any human reasoning can get to on its own. And I think that's the theme with regards to saying, you know, these barely a crime, that when humans trying to reason through science or through their own intellect, invariably what happens is the human dignity of the person in some degree or another of a certain type of person is diminished. The dignity of the human person and the dignity of every individual human person somehow suffers when dictators or powerful people try to press their points of view on the cultures.
Yeah, well, I should copy all that down that you just said. I will record that as that's the theme of Barely a Crime. Very yeah. Good.
Well, I applaud you for writing it, and I do think that it is the truth that people wonder, you know, without the church and without the Judeo-Christian values in a culture, we are really left to the most powerful people, and they're going to impress a point of view on us or on the culture that simply because they're in power becomes the truth. It's not really the truth, but it becomes truth to people. And I think as you reference this confusion among young people who are not being taught what God reveals in terms of dignity and truth and beauty and goodness, they're very confused and are left really to illogical reasons of thinking, ways of thinking.
I agree. I think that really is an area of concern and a need for prayer. If you look at the millennials and what that culture considers as, you know, life-giving entertainment and life-giving interests, and, you know, from political to spiritual to, you know, personal family structures and, you know, everything across the board. And there's a different world being shaped, and it is not, it's a world of priceless people in desperate need, but they don't really understand that that's where they are, and they're digging such a hole for themselves. Like I say, I really do feel sorry for my grandkids, especially because the weight bearing down on them from the culture as a whole, I'm afraid it may not be the with all the windows open and the light shining that I had when I grew up, or that you probably had when you grew up. The culture makes huge, huge difference, and this one is in a bit of a whirlpool and circling toward the center, which really could be a serious, serious plunge.
Yeah, and that is the idea of scandal, that we are either here to enlighten our brothers or sisters or to lead them into ways that aren't good for them, and that would be scandal, which is
something
we don't need to think about anymore.
Yeah, and God bless you for the program and, you know, the different Catholic radio stations. That's terrific ministry across that spectrum.
Well, we have to thank Mother Angelica, whose vision this was, and who we are an affiliate of, and knowing that God...
Oh, I didn't realize you were an affiliate of
Yes, that. Right, yeah, no, and God's word is going out continuously, and that you are open to his will and doing his will in your works. But I wanted to ask you once more to give the title of the book and to let people know where they can find you. And you mentioned a beautiful thing, Couple Prayer, where that's available as well.
Yeah, the Couple Prayer program, and we do have a couple prayer at gmail.com. We got a contact us information there about Kathy and I, but that's Couple Prayer as one word, couplepraye.com. into a place where they can be praying together every day, you know, with scripture, with devotions, with, you know, however they find their prayer that day. Prayer is really, really critical. And I'm quite sure, because I've done this, we've done this now in probably 100 churches, we've asked the congregation or asked the celebrant to ask the congregation if they would raise their hands if they're married at the present time, and you get an idea of that number. And then he'll say, of those people who just raised your hand, would you raise your hand again if you and your spouse pray together as a couple? We're not talking about next to each other in church, but at home or wherever you are, in the car, over the phone, but you actually turn to God together as a couple and you share your heart's real prayers, whatever prayers are dear to your heart, with one another as a couple. If that's a regular, ongoing part of your marriage, would you raise your hand again? And it's a life lesson. You do not see many hands go up. I personally believe, Kathy and I believe, after 15 years and now working with people to pray together, I really think that maybe the biggest wound in the body of Christ is that married couples, at a time when marriage itself, as you know and we all know, is a desperately defended post, couples really are not praying together as a regular part of their marriage relationship. And I think any listener could find that to be true in their own parish. So that's the couple prayer site. And then the book itself, probably the easiest way or an easy way is just to go on a book selling, you know, go online like Amazon has it. And the reviews have started to come in, too. That may be encouraging to people or interesting to people. They just go to Amazon and type in Barely a Crime or Barely a Crime, O-V-I-E-S is my last name. And easy to remember because it's spelled like movies, but you take off the M, and there it is, O-V-I-E-S. So if it becomes Barely a Crime, O-V-S, and the book will come up, and they can read the industry reviews on the back cover. They let you flip over to the back cover. And on the Ignatius site, they actually have the first chapter on the site, so they can get a feel of the writing and the ease of reading it and that kind of thing, which is very helpful. I really appreciate what Ignatius does for it and for everything else they do, too, right?
Absolutely, but yes.
Those would be the two ways with a couple prayer series in the book, I think, is easiest to get to.
Well, thank you so much for your time this morning. We've been speaking with author Robert Oves, and he, again, has written the book called Barely a Crime. It is a novel, and it has got very high recommendations from all of your respected fellow Catholic authors. So we just applaud what you've done with this and wish you the best for your upcoming spiritual book, which we hope we will see soon. And just thank you again for being with us this morning.
Well, thank you. It's really, it has been a blessing to me, and God bless you.
Well, thank you so much.